Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Patterson. I'm back again and again for another incredible episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And my guest this week is another rock star, a very different story for me. I'm very excited to jump into it in just a minute. But before we go there, I want to remind everybody to please go onto my website if you want to find out any information about my speaking or my blog. It actually says Everest, which is one of the menu bars at the top. And of course, you can find all the different podcasts. And speaking of the podcast, if you go in and give a ratings and review on iTunes, I would greatly appreciate it. It helps in getting the word out about all these amazing people doing incredible things. Okay, so very excited as I started off with about my guest today. His name is Randall Reeves. Randall, how you doing?
Doing well, Mark. Thanks for the invite today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so we're sitting here talking on April 16th, and this pod will probably run in a month from now. And it's really interesting that we're sitting right in the thick of the COVID-19 crisis around the planet. And that's exactly where you've been, all over the planet, not with COVID-19, but you know, your whole background, which we're going to dive really deep into today. You're just this incredible explorer that's been all over the globe in a boat, and you've done things that literally nobody on the planet has ever done. And probably at this point in time right now with this crisis, there's probably no better place to be than on your 45-foot aluminum boat floating out there somewhere in the sea.
Yeah, you'd think, right? You'd think because you're certainly not going to catch COVID-19 out in the middle of nowhere. The only challenge there, Mark, is that you can't come in anywhere. Right now, pretty much all the ports are closed. So it's committing. If you're going to go out to sea to escape COVID-19, you better be prepared to be there for a long while.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because, you know, you've spent, you know, at least 306 days at sea. And so the question is, what the hell are you doing, you know, 306 days, 8 months, you know, out sailing? And what I want to start with, and as I was going back on your history, you do have this log of incredible sailing tales to different exotic places around the planet. But this last one that you just came off of, it seemed like it was the one that really put you on the map in 2018. And essentially what you were doing is trying to become the first ever person to attempt and circumnavigate the Americas in Antarctica by yourself.
By myself and in 1 year and back home in 1 year. So the figure eight boy, just really quickly, for those people who aren't really clear on the geography. So imagine a globe, if you would, in your hand, and you looking right down at San Francisco. Figure eight voyage is an attempt to sail from San Francisco all the way south, all the way to the bottom of the world, down to the bottom of South America, make a hard left, go all the way around Antarctica, back to South America again, all the way up the Atlantic, way, way up into the Arctic, into what we call the Northwest Passage, make a hard left there, across the top of Canada, Alaska, and back home to San Francisco, about 40,000 miles in 1 year. Really challenging bit of water, because you're going all the time, for one thing, and you're in some amazingly difficult places.
So let's get into that. So the first thing is, how did you ever come up with this idea? I mean, where was this? what was the spark for this inspiration?
I left my home and my lovely wife in 2010 for my dream voyage. I was going to sail by myself from San Francisco to Mexico, to Hawaii, and back home in a year. And I had been saving up and practicing for that forever. And I got down into Mexico and spent the winter of the Sea of Cortez and realized that all the sailors down there were headed for this place I'd never heard of, called the Marquesas. And I did some research, realized that's, you know, that's in French Polynesia where we find Tahiti, and thought, wow, that's just really cool. I want to go there. So invited my lovely wife down to La Paz and talked to her about what it would be like to do this extra long voyage. Oh, how long would it take, sweetheart? Well, it's going to take another year given distances and hurricane seasons. So your one-year voyage is will become a two-year voyage. Yes, honey, I'm afraid that's what it'll be. She thinks for a moment. She says, well, I think you should do that, which just shocked the hell out of me. But so I left on a one-year cruise that was going to be Mexico, Hawaii, and home, and it turned into a two-year cruise that was Mexico, Hawaii, French Polynesia, Alaska, home, and got home and realized, wow, you know what? I really enjoyed that. I really found it challenging and satisfying. And when I paused to reflect, what I found most satisfying were the long ocean passages. So those required a month from one place to the other. And I thought, well, you know, what could one do that would be super challenging along those lines? And about that time, a guy named Matt Rutherford had just circumnavigated the Americas. And no one that I knew of had combined that with circumnavigation of Antarctica. And that was kind of where the idea came from. I really wanted to get back out to sea. I really wanted to see if I could push the limits and what those limits were.
It's just incredible. You know, so in 2019, January of last year, I actually flew to Antarctica and I climbed Vincent Massif.
Yes.
And so in order to do that, the route that I had to go is LAX to Chile, yep. Santiago, down to Punta Arenas. And then I think it's not too far from there, which is the tip now of South America. And then not too far from there is Cape Horn. And between Cape Horn and Antarctica sits the Drake Passage. And yep. It's literally, I looked it up last night. And I knew it at the time, but I just wanted to check my facts. And they call it the most treacherous water. I said I typed in Google, the most treacherous water in the planet. And it's the Drake Passage. And for people that understand, think about, you know, the South America in Antarctica, which is like a gigantic island that sit with distance in between each other. And so there's this water channel that runs through the tip. And it's just, it's cold, it's windy. It's high seas, it's tides. I mean, everything that you can throw on that fastball, you got coming for you. And so for you to go take that on, tell me about the Drake Passage. What was that like? I saw a little bit of footage. I mean, it just seemed really amazing. Like you could be out there in this 45-foot boat. Sorry for the helicopter above me. You could be out there in this 45-foot boat and you could be surviving waves and swells, I'm sure that at times were at least double that you're trying to get through. I mean, how do you do that?
When you are doing it, you sometimes wonder why you're doing it, right?
Yeah.
Cape Horn, to sailors, Cape Horn is known as the Everest of sailing. It is, as you pointed out, the nastiest, most difficult bit of water you can find. And part of the reason for that is that it's a very rugged and difficult piece of land sticking way, way, way down into the ocean, 56 degrees south. It's one of the furthest south pieces of land other than Antarctica itself. And then Antarctica has a large peninsula sticking up toward Cape Horn. So all of this water that has been, and understand that the wind down there blows from west to east. So clockwise around Antarctica, just around and around and around. So you've got these huge swells just going around and around and around all the time. And then they have to kind of be compressed in to the 600-mile-wide gap between the southern tip of South America, Cape Horn, and the northern tip of Antarctica. And it is just super challenging. It is not at all uncommon to have 45, 50-knot winds, seas that are 25, 30 feet high, breaking seas, and then added into that difficulty is then not hitting the land, right? Getting around and through that quote-unquote narrow passage without achieving catastrophe. It's really challenging. It's where I really came to grief my first time on the first figure eight voyage. I don't know if you are aware that I've tried this twice.
Yeah, you pushed back the first time in 2017.
That's right. Yeah, I met my first really big storm was right off Cape Horn. It was about 500 miles west. And got into a gale that had 50 knot winds gusting 70. We did okay through most of the gale, but in the last part of the storm, the boat got knocked down. So technically, in sailor terms, a knockdown is when the boat is knocked all the way over, 180 degrees, mast in the water, wave raking over the boat. That happened, got a little bit of boat water in the boat, knocked out the autopilot. And on the next day, the mechanical device that I used to steer the boat also was disabled. So I'm at 56 South, 500 miles west of Cape Horn, and I have no way to automatically steer the boat. So a boat that's 45 feet long, like mine, is not designed to be steered by one guy on a tiller. So it was really challenging.
Okay, wait. Stop here. So,
okay.
Yeah. No, this is incredible. So what you're telling me is that you're in what is known as one of the most treacherous passages on the planet. You're in the worst conditions. There's 70 mile per hour winds coming at you, and it tips your boat over. Where are you? Are you under in the cabin underneath, or are you somewhere or another on the deck and trying to figure out how you're going to right the ship back up?
No, luckily I was not on deck. That when the boat gets knocked down, and I've, you know, having spent as much time as I have in the Southern Ocean at this point, two tries and twice around Cape Horn, you get knocked down a fair bit. And I've not had the misfortune of being on deck. That would be very challenging. You're with water just coursing over the boat like it would be, it's very difficult to stay attached to the boat. When you're on deck, you're always in a harness and an attachment to the boat. But it would be really challenging. I've been fortunate that I've been below each time we've been knocked down.
Okay, so take any one of these times, and we'll focus on this particular time in 2017. So you're inside, you know, it's all sealed up. And now you get knocked over, and your boat is more or less just floating out there, disabled. How do you get a boat upright again?
Oh, sorry. Right. You did ask that. These boats, ocean voyaging boats, and most of the sailboats that you see out on any bay, anywhere, are what we call heavy displacement boats. They have a large keel made out of lead. It's a lot of weight all underneath that hull, that white hull you can see above the water. And the purpose of having all of that weight down there is to keep the boat stable and to keep the boat upright. So a boat like mine, when it gets knocked over, it's a matter of seconds before it comes back upright again. That doesn't mean you've come up damage-free necessarily. Typically, a knockdown on a smaller boat or a lighter boat can take the mast out. That's a big danger in the Southern Ocean. Most of the race boats that have problems have either the keels fall off or the mast comes out. So keeping the mast up in the boat when the boat goes down into the water is a big deal. But this boat is built super strong. It's built specifically for this kind of voyaging. It has a rig so strong that when the guys at the boatyard look at it, they say, oh, this is too big. This is made for boats that are 200 feet. So it's really made to be rolled, made to be knocked down, made to be able to do things like that without too much injury.
Okay, so now the winds eventually calm down, the boat rights itself,
yep.
But you're essentially disabled out there because you don't have your automatic pilot system in place,
right?
And some of the other things to make the boat go. So what's the plan now to get your boat safely back to, I guess, some port, right, to either get repaired, or what was the plan?
Very close to where you pulled in. My target was Ushuaia, which is the town furthest south in Argentina, 500 miles east of me. And the challenge for me was that although the boat is designed to do this kind of voyaging, it's designed to be steered by a mechanism, not by a human. I have a tiller, which is not a steering wheel, but a tiller, which is just a long rod attached to the rudder. It's just kind of short. It doesn't give me a lot of leverage. And so I had to hand steer. There was no other option. I hand steered 12 to 18 hours a day for 5 days to get into Ushuaia. I would heave to at night, which in this case simply meant lashing the tiller to one side of the boat and letting the boat do whatever in the big seas that were out there. And that was pretty frightening. I didn't have another gale until I got right offshore. But you're in the South, and the South has big seas always. You know, just mountains of water coming at you. So it was really challenging. It was really cold. It was frightening. It's sleet and hail temperature. And you're trying to, you know, you muscle this tiller. You're in big seas. There's a lot of pressure pushing on the rudder always. And so it took, for me, I'm not a huge guy, it took pretty maximal physical strength most days to make it happen. So you're you're cold, you're working really hard. When you take a break, you're dashing down below to put like three cans of soup in the tin. You heat it up as much as you can. You eat it as quickly as you can because you want that heat. I don't use any heat in the boat when I'm in the oceans, when I'm in big seas like that. So it's cold and it's frightening. But we got into a rhythm after a while. It's also stunningly beautiful. Big, beautiful seas, big, beautiful sky. You've got birds all around you all the time, albatross and prions that even in the worst of weather are just absolutely at home, live 95% of their lives at sea and are adapted entirely to this environment where you are just daily struggling to keep it together.
What time of year was this? What month of the year was it?
This would have been just coming on Christmas, which is southern summer, right?
Yeah.
So that's the target. One of the challenges of the figure eight is that I'm trying to do the entire thing in a year. I'm trying to be in the southern parts of the world in southern summer and in the northern parts of the world in the northern summer. So in the southern summer, that's the best time to be there. And there's no getting through the Arctic in the winter because it's frozen solid. So
the timing was
part of the interesting part of the challenge.
Yeah. When you're in the world of mountain climbing, you're doing essentially the exact same thing, right?
Yep.
So when I've climbed in South America and Antarctica, it's been during our winter months, their summer months. So just the opposite. Okay, so you limp into this port not too far away from where I was, Punta Arenas in Chile. How long does it take for you to get repaired? And then it seems, though, that the reason why you didn't just continue with this voyage is because you wouldn't have clocked in under a year by the time you got all the way back to San Francisco.
No, not quite. You're close. So it took me about a month to do the repairs. Part of the challenge was just getting stuff into Argentina, right? I had to have my wife come down and put a new steering device in her suitcase and get that through customs. So that was its own, getting the boat put back together was its own adventure. Yep. Took me about a month to get launched again. And then, so that was day 56, actually. Leave San Francisco, 56 days later, knock down, lose steering. In port, leave again. About day 85, I'm halfway across the Indian Ocean and between South Africa and Australia. In the Indian Ocean, which is famous for really terrible weather.
Yeah.
I'm above these islands owned by the French called the Crozets, and I'm overtaken again by a really big storm. The challenge there is the water gets a bit shallow and the currents tend to be contrary. So the waves are not only tall, but they're super steep and crashing. And I just couldn't figure this particular gale out. I tried everything. We were knocked down two or three times overnight, and in the morning, the light is just coming on. I'm in the pilot house. I've just jibed around, trying to tape the seas on a slightly different angle. And I feel the boat is picked up. Like, you can just feel it, like picked up, spun sideways and thrown sideways down onto the bottom of the sea. Huge. And so the boat weighs 20 tons. Imagine a thing that weighs 20 tons being thrown like it's a dog toy. It's quite amazing. We hit the bottom of the sea. Kind of this swoosh, nice, soft landing. But then I notice I can see through one of the windows, which I couldn't before because it was covered with spray. And I notice I can now hear the gale, which I couldn't before because I'm closed inside the pilot house. And I notice there's water everywhere. And only then do I realize that as we've come down, we've bursted out one of the big windows in the pilot house and the boat is full of water. And all this water has come in over the nav station. So all my electronics are knocked out, my navigation electronics, communication electronics. So on day 84, I'm disabled again. And I limp for a month into Hobart, Tasmania. And there, to your earlier point, there's where I realized, you know what, this isn't going so well.
Yeah. So this is the big island off Australia.
That's right. South Australia.
Yep, yep.
And it's south part of that island is a town of Tasmania. So what I realized then is that by the time I've gotten the boat put back together to launch again, even if I'm successful at getting underneath Cape Horn for the second time, I will probably be too late into the Arctic. The Arctic timing is extremely sensitive. You've about 5,000 miles of really icy run. You've only got 60 days to do it. Otherwise, you're stuck. Right? You get trapped for the winter.
Yeah, you're Shackleton.
Yeah, well, if you're lucky, right?
Yeah.
But you're at least stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. So I decided I could, the options were to hang out for a year and start again from Tasmania, or, and that just seemed like the not very adventuresome way of going about it. So I decided to sail home and try again the next year. So I sailed from Tasmania nonstop back to San Francisco. I did a full circumnavigation of the globe in like 8 months. But definitely a failed attempt at the figure eight. And that was 2017, 2018. I left again in the fall of 2018 for try number two.
Wow. Okay, so let's pick it up. Now you are successfully making it down. You're going back through, this time successfully through the Drake Passage, and now you're going around Antarctica. What kind of, and again, this is 2018, what kind of challenges did you have going around Antarctica? Because, you know, look, I was down there in the mid to late January of 2019, and everywhere I could see, there wasn't a drop of green. It was 100% ice and snow everywhere.
Yeah, it's amazing in the degree to how alien and how foreign it is. So I didn't see any ice. There are many times you'll come around Cape Horn, and for the next week or two, between Cape Horn and the Falklands, and then even a little further north, you'll see icebergs that have broken off of Drake Passage or up off of Antarctica. Did not see any this time, but you're in a really alien environment. So the ocean, what makes up 2/3 of the planet,
yeah,
and you're in a part of that planet where the wind is high all the time. The wind travels around Antarctica, west to east, goes around and around and around the globe. And it travels fast, and it's cold. So the seas are big, the air is cold. Everything you do is challenging because you're having to hang on all the time. It's a little bit like having a camper on top of a mechanical bull. If you chop the onion for the soup, and then as you reach for the soup pan, if you let go of the onion, it's on the floor. And then as you're reaching for the onion, if you let go of the soup pan, it's on the floor. And you're bruised and banged up all the time, and there's no heat, and it's wet. It does not matter how careful you are. And I'm sure there are corollaries to mountain climbing in this regard. It doesn't matter how careful you are. Wet gets everywhere. I had mold on the inside of the boat, just not because I was being careless, but just because you're in a wet environment and there's spray all the time. One of the great cruisers from about the 1970s was once asked, what's the best technique for sailing in the Southern Ocean? And his one sentence was, keep the water out. And as it turns out, that's really hard to do.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's amazing. And it's a great privilege to be there. But it took me 3 months, 110 days to sail from Cape Horn all the way around and back to Cape Horn again, 15,000 miles at about an average of about 47 degrees south, an average of about one gale per week during that time. And it's hard. It's just hard. And you are worn out by the time you get to Cape Horn a second time.
Yeah. So what are the most incredible creatures, mammals, animals? You know, you probably saw lots of penguins, but there's got to be some incredible moments where whales are coming up, or there's, dolphins, or I don't know what that would be for you, but do any jump off? And it might not just be this particular gigantic voyage, but it might be something in the South Pacific or other places that you've been up in Alaska. What has stood out to you in terms of just, breathtaking beauty?
In the North, during the Northwest Passage, you'll see walruses and polar bears and a lot of the big animals that a lot of people talk about. But I think one of the most incredible animals for me, as I alluded to just a few minutes ago, is seeing the albatross. One of the real breathtaking things about being in the Southern Ocean is that you're surrounded by wildlife all the time. You sail in the middle latitudes, San Francisco to Hawaii or the Caribbean, you'll see stuff occasionally, birds and porpoises and dolphins and things like that. But in the South, there is so much food that there's animal life is just all around you. Clouds of prions, which are little pigeon-sized birds, just like always around the boat. But the most amazing animal down there is what's called the wandering albatross. It's, I think, the largest bird now living. Is something on the order of a 12-foot wingspan. And it is It is designed for gliding. It can lock its wings in place when it's in the air, and it will fly and doing these wonderful loops and like surfing waves without apparently moving at all. And they'll come in and they'll hover above the boat. And they, like I said earlier, you're struggling, right? You're really just trying to keep everything together, trying to keep the boat going. And you're in this alien environment now for weeks and weeks and months. And it's challenging. And you watch this bird that just hovers there as if it's the easiest thing in the world. And it has a wingspan that's as wide as my boat. Lives all its life at sea. It sees land maybe once a year when it mates and raises young. Other than that, it's out in the middle of the ocean. And I just love that. It's like meeting an alien creature because of its, it could well be that it has never seen a human before. I've had birds in the middle latitudes, storm petrels at night will sometimes chase the boat because the turbulence of the boat will bring up shrimps and other little things that they eat. But sometimes they miss and they hit the boat, and sometimes they'll fall into the hatches. And I've woken up in the middle of the night with this bird flapping around inside the boat. I get to hold it in my hand as I'm setting it free. And I think to myself, wow, I'm holding this animal in my hand that has never seen a human. What a cool, privileged thing to be able to do.
There was a guy I had on the pod last year, and he had, his story, it was on 60 Minutes, had fallen over in the Indian Ocean. He was on his way to a guy's doggo to go surfing or something. And it's this whole tale of him surviving 26 hours in the ocean with these albatross and other birds dive bombing and trying to pluck his eyeballs out. It was just this incredible story, right? He's out there like seriously, how this happened.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's wind this back to 2018 and you're circumnavigating, trying to do this figure eight. Now you've come around Antarctica, you're back at Cape Horn, which again, you're basically at the bottom of South America. And for those people who don't know the geography, it used to be back in the day, it would be the only way for these international ships carrying goods and services back and forth until they built the Panama Canal, which then allowed you to essentially just cut through from one side to the other without having to circle all the way down to the bottom, saving a lot of time and energy and safety, right?
That's right. That's exactly correct. This is called the Clipper Route, that route around the bottom of the world, because to your point, until the building of the Panama Canal, it was the only way to get goods from Asia to Europe and vice versa. So every ship that went around the world via the south.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of shipwrecks, you know, sitting at the bottom of Cape Horn right now. Okay, so now you push on, and now that you're heading your way back up South America into North America, and what was that like? And I assume you had navigation devices, and you must have had either, whether it was internet or you had some kind of satellite, so you're communicating with your wife and other people. But now the goal is to get back in the San Francisco Harbor, From what I saw, you had quite a crowd of people, of enthusiasts that had been following this journey of yours. So that must have been so rewarding to have actually pulled this thing off. You know, I'm trying to become the first NFL player to climb the seven summits, and I am not there yet. I'm supposed to be at Everest Base Camp. You know, I would have taken off 15, 16 days ago. That didn't happen. C-19 blew everything up around the world. Everest was one of those things. So kind of like your 217 where you got pushed back, right, at sea. This is what I'm going through today. And so I pushed everything to next year. And the goal is still the same. What was that like for you when now you're like touching the top and you're coming back down and you've actually done it?
Well, you don't get too far ahead there, right? That particular leap was really, really challenging as well, but for completely different reasons. So from Cape Horn up to the Arctic turned out to be a really slow, relaxing, fun run. But the Northwest Passage, even though it is more accessible now because there's less ice, it is not more accessible every year. And the last several years in particular have been very challenging. As it turns out, I was fortunate that I didn't attempt it in 2017-18. That was a really bad year. Of the, I don't know, 20 or 30 boats that tried, only one made it through because of ice not melting and not getting out of the way. It was better in the year that I went through, but it was still a real touch and go for about 1,000 miles in the center of the passage.
So let me ask you this. So for those that don't know, so my hometown is Seattle, Washington, right? Mm. I've spent a lot of time up in the San Juans, and I've actually worked on a fishing boat up in Alaska. And so when you say the Northwest Passage, I know what you're talking about. Would you define what that is so people have an idea of now you're basically cruising right past San Francisco and you're headed towards, you've got, you know, the geography is California, Oregon, Washington, and then you've got this gap of Canada, and now you go up into to Alaska. So when you talk about the Northwest Passage, describe what you're trying to do.
Sure. And point of clarity, I'm actually going up the Atlantic.
Oh, the other side.
Yeah. So that's the part of the eight, right? Going up the Atlantic and into the Northwest Passage from the east side. So the Cape Horn route that we've been talking about, that was a really historic passage called the Clipper Route for the reasons we've talked about, because there was no Panama Canal. The Northwest Passage is a really historic route as well, because people have forever and a day been trying to find a shorter way to get from Europe to Asia than going around the bottom, because it's so dangerous. So I've been reading, so ever since I got back, I've been reading about this nonstop. We've been looking for the Northwest Passage since the middle 1400s. Basically, there is water above Alaska and Canada if it's not frozen. And if it's not frozen, there is a waterway connecting, you know, the eastern seaboard with the west of America over the top of Canada and Alaska. And that's called the Northwest Passage. Very challenging because it goes through a very large archipelago of islands on the eastern side that don't flush out. They tend to hold onto the ice late in the year. So the whole run from, say, St. John's, Newfoundland to Nome, Alaska across the top is about 5,000-6,000 miles. Long way, very maze-like in its characteristics. And you've only got 60 days to pull it off. Otherwise, it starts to freeze up again. So the goal is to arrive at the eastern end of the Northwest Passage, which is about midway up Greenland on the Canadian side. Arrive there about middle August and begin making your way in. And you're always kind of coming up to the edge of the ice, letting it melt, coming up to the edge of the ice, letting it melt, and have the goal of being out over the top of Alaska, a place called Point Barrow, before August. So not very much time, and a lot can go wrong. And like the South, there's not much going on up there. You know, when I cracked up off Cape Horn back in 2017, one of the challenges was there's nobody to call for help. There's nobody down there. Argentina, Chile, they don't have Coast Guard. You know, you're literally on your own. Now with the Panama Canal, there's no shipping down there. Somewhat similar in the Northwest Passage. There are villages every 1,000 miles or so for fuel if you need it. But you got to get there. And it's a 1,000 miles in a boat that goes 6 miles an hour. It's a long, long ways.
In terms of getting food, because again, I just want to like repoint all these different voyages that you've done in 2014, 216, 217, 280, all these things. It's all just you. It's a solo mission. Yep. So I want to ask you two things. One about just the loneliness, and maybe there isn't that because you've got so much going on. And then the second point that I want to ask you is about, you know, the various, your supplies, right? Mm-hmm. And how do you refill? I don't know if that boat also has a small little engine that you need to get fuel and things like that, but you know, it just, are you ever pulling into some port to resupply yourself and then off you go again?
It took me about 2 years to find the right boat for the figure eight voyage. The boat that I had was 30 feet long, plenty strong, but not fast enough and not big enough to carry enough stores and spare parts. Not only do you have to have your own supply of food and water, your own hardware store as well. If anything breaks, and lots of stuff is going to break, you have to be able to fix it with what you have. So part of the challenge is having enough food and water and spare parts to fix everything. So I purposefully looked for a vessel that could hold a year's worth of food and water. Oh. So I didn't need that much at the end of the day, but I wanted to. You figure kind of 1.5 times the actual predicted length of the voyage is what you want to have in extra food. So I left San Francisco with a year's worth of food and was on a nonstop leg. So San Francisco down around the bottom and up to Halifax, Nova Scotia, 237 days. So about 8 months and about 31,000 miles. That was all nonstop. Didn't see land except for Cape Horn twice. And I was pretty low. I mean, I ran out of beer. I mean, that's a really terrible day. I allowed myself one beer a day, and I ran out about 180 days into it. That was terrible.
So isn't there a temptation, though, that, you know, you're sailing down and, you know, you're in Tahiti or someplace, you know, wherever you are on all these different expeditions that you've been on, and you just go, you know what, I just feel like pulling in and getting some chips and saying hi just for that human, right?
All right. You want the real answer?
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Yeah, good.
No, the goal was really bright and shiny in my brain, right? And for me, the biggest attraction of the figure eight was the nonstop aspect. I've been dreaming about doing long nonstop passages since I was a kid.
Yeah.
So the longer, the better from my perspective. It is certainly challenging to go that long without seeing another human face. But there are many other things that you get to see and participate with and interact with that are very fulfilling as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was joking around, and I can certainly understand what you're talking about, because as a mountain climber, mountaineer, I'm so driven by the end goal, and that's what fuels me through. Like, I don't want to go and visit the small little village. I just want to go climb the mountain, and that's what my whole brain is warped towards doing and thinking, and that's what the drive is, and that's why I don't spend a lot of time, you know, doing your typical tourist things that other people would probably do. Okay, so now let's go back. And so now you've gone through the Northwest Passage safely, and you're coming around Alaska, and now you're coming down past, you know, Washington, Oregon, and coming into San Francisco. How was that?
It was great. The Northwest Passage turned out to be a real challenge. We had lots of ice contact. There were some periods during that part of the voyage where it wasn't clear that we were going to make it through that year. So the relief of getting over the top and starting to head south, down toward Nome, Alaska, through the Aleutian Islands and back into the Pacific, just the sheer relief of knowing that we'd gotten through the last of the ice was amazing. I mean, there were times... One of the big challenges in the Northwest Passage is sleep. You don't have time to sleep, because if the ice is open, you go. So you're always, you just go, and you're sleeping in these, you know, maybe an hour or two a day, you'll just kind of crash out. Let the boat drift for an hour or two and you'll crash out. So there were times where I would be going and I'd see a blue water ahead. I think, oh, great, no ice for a while. I'd rush down below. I'd set the alarm for like a 10-minute nap. Really, can I just have 10 minutes? And bam, slamming into ice about, you know, the sixth minute of my nap. And that can really be unnerving, I tell you, because you're in the middle of nowhere. And if you go in that water, you're not going to last more than 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So getting beyond the stress of that and getting into the south, now we're beyond the ice, we're headed south, we're headed home, was a big relief. We had some very difficult weather in the last week. One of the biggest gales that we had was a mere 300 miles offshore San Francisco here. But by that point, you know, big stormy weather, we'd seen a lot of it. I was very confident in the boat's ability to take it. So it was great to feel like we're on the homeward stretch. And then coming home, I think, 10 or 15 boats came out to see me in under the Golden Gate Bridge. My wife had arranged for a bunch of people to meet me at a yacht club here in San Francisco. That was a lot of fun, really gratifying to have set the goal, a goal I didn't initially know how to accomplish. I didn't know how to set the spec for it, to have failed the first time, to have been successful the second time, and to complete it. It was really a great feeling. A lot of fun.
That's awesome. I've got some questions I want to come back to in a minute on that. I just want to relay one story. Back in the day, I was 18 years old, and I'd gone to the University of Washington. I was on scholarship, and back in the day, they used to help us during the summer get jobs. And somehow or another, I got this job to go up and work on a processing boat up in Alaska. So you have this kid that doesn't know jack about the ocean or anything else outside of growing up around Seattle, you know, just lakes and everything. And we end up in the Barents Sea. We're on a 165-foot processing boat, and we're up going. We're at False Pass, which is the last island in the Aleutian chain. And the goal was to go north up to Naknek, and that's where all these boats were going to gather and catch fish and then give them to us. And to do that, we ended up in a superstorm that we had waves that I'm sure we're 30 feet. We couldn't see land. It was at night. They were coming over our entire boat, 165 feet. And I was flipping, freaking out. I was starting to write my letters, you know, goodbye. I was going to give my teddy bear to my best friend and all this stuff. But just want to interject that really quickly. But fast forwarding, okay, so now you're coming into San Francisco Bay. You've got some boats that come out there. They meet, they greet you. You got your wife there. You pull up. And one of the things that people keep asking me, and I have my answer, but I want to hear your answer, is that you've now completed this lifelong dream. You become that first person ever. And as I go to do something completely different but similar in terms of the, you know, the goal of the first, they keep saying, is that it? So I'm asking you that question. Is this it?
No. The short answer is no.
Yeah.
The longer answer is more difficult, though, right? I'm not entirely sure what the next challenge is yet. I got home on October 19, so we're still a little bit shy of 6 months of being back. And I've been at this particular goal. I'm sure you understand this. I mean, it was life-consuming. I did nothing but the figure eight voyage from about 2013 through October of last year. And so one of the challenges for me has been letting go. It's been my career for so long now. So yeah, I have the same question. What's next? I don't know the answer. When you know, let me know. But well, one of the things I realized in the figure eight, as much as it was a privilege to do that, and as much as one can't say that a boat that goes an average of 7 miles an hour is fast, I have the impression of having gone around the world too quickly. It's like your Everest climb where you're not interested in seeing the village. Well, that was me on the figure eight voyage. I was just interested in going. So my interest now would be to do something of that caliber, but where I stop. Like, what if I were able to freeze in Antarctica for the winter, and or freeze into the Arctic for the winter, be able to experience that environment, but without, you know, that constant push to go, which is what the figure eight voyage was.
Well, I'm sure part of that formula has to do with your wife and how she feels about you going off in 5 year, take your time. Yeah. So you got to stuff her in the cabin and off you go. You know, my answer to that same question has been, you know, there's the whole new set of challenges. There's all these places. I mean, you've been a lot of places and you've accomplished a lot, but think of all the places that you haven't been. And I don't know what those are for you, but I know that that there's a list. And for me, there's a list. There's the second highest mountains in the world. There's this whole notion about trying to climb every the highest mountain in every state. Turns out I've done four of the 50, which also happen to turn out to be the hardest ones on the list. So, I've been thinking about how I'm going to go around, jump in a Sprinter van or something and go make that happen. So I think there's just always a new way to kind of reinvent. It might not be the first, but there's only so many firsts that are out there, right? But it's the question, the real question to me is, what's going to challenge you and get you out of bed?
Yeah, and I love that question, because that's what I really learned about myself during the figure eight voyage, was that I did have a goal-driven part of me that really flourished in that exercise. And so the question is, what to find next that uses the skills that I've developed that will be different enough and challenging enough to be interesting too. I really enjoyed the challenge of it, and I really enjoyed communicating about it along the way. To answer your earlier question, no, there's no internet at sea. It doesn't exist. But I had sponsored fairly high-tech satellite connectivity that allowed me to send high resolution photographs and video back from sea. So I posted every single day from sea for a full 2 years. And that became part of the challenge. That became part of the habit. Telling the story as it happened was a lot of fun. So I'd like to not only find another physical challenge that would be of interest to me, but of interest to other people. By the time I got back, I think there were as many as 10,000 people visiting the website every day. And the funny thing is, when you have access to the web stats, you get to see that people are really much more interested in what you're doing when you're about to die, and much less interested in you when things are easy. Yep. So I have to find these things that are really challenging.
Yeah, I get that. Well, it's like a real live, episode of Survivor. right?
Totally.
Okay. So I know one of the things that you've been busy at, and I want to talk just quickly as we kind of wrap things up, is you are now also an author, a publisher. And so tell me about your book, Figure Eight.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for asking. One of the first jobs my wife sent me to when I got home was to take the voyage and put it into a book. And if you followed the Figure Eight voyage at all, you'll know that writing is one of the things I really enjoy. So that was not a challenge that was difficult to push me toward. But what I did was, along the way, I not only wrote every day, but I posted photographs. And I have found very difficult putting those two together in one format. So what I've chosen to do was to publish an illustrated book, a picture book, shall we say, of the Figure Eight voyage, 100 pages, 250 photographs of everywhere in the world that you'll probably never, ever go, you know, out in the middle of the ocean for 384 days from one end to the other. And that's been really well received. I'm pleased. Self-published, and it arrived, I think, a month and a half ago, and I sold out of the first run in about 8 days, which was really gratifying.
Congrats.
So that's done, and that's the next batch is on the way. But what I will really want to do personally, just because it's my bailiwick, is the narrative of the Figure Eight voyage. I'm looking forward to starting to take the blogs that I wrote every day and put those into a format that will be just one full story. So that's coming up in fall.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. I mean, I think it's one thing to say you want to write a book, and it's another thing to actually do it, go out there and make it happen. And it's just the drive of all the pieces that come together, and you did it. And so, you know, it's another check, you know, on the run bar that you've done, and congratulations to you. Okay, so where can people find you? Because I want to make sure that as you're formulating this new idea about what's next, that when you do a news flash, that people can actually find you and follow your journey.
Thanks. I appreciate that question too. So I'm going to be keeping the Figure Eight Voyage website active for quite some time. So figure8voyage.com. That's figure the word, eight the number, voyage the word .com. And that's where I keep the blog. And I've actually kept the blog going after I've come back ashore. And that's where I'll have the book, so people who are interested in the book can order it from there. But that's probably where I'll begin talking about the next adventure for sure.
That's great. That's great. Love it. Love it. And by the way, I spent quite a bit of time on your website, and it's very visual. So if anybody wants to get inspired, please go and check that out. And the one thing I love about a quote that I saw either you or somebody else said is that you're out there inspiring others to do the impossible. So keep doing what you do. Okay.
I promise. Thanks, man.
Awesome. All right. Listen, thank you so much for coming on the pod, and look forward to getting this out to the planet, and everybody can hear your incredible tale.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Again, I appreciate the interest. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Attention parents and grandparents. If you're looking for a gift that's more than just a toy, give them something that inspires confidence and adventure all year long. Give them a Guardian bike, the easiest, safest, and number one kids bike on the market. With USA-made, kid-specific frames and patented safety technology, kids are learning to ride in just one day. No training wheels needed. It's why Guardian is America's favorite kids bike and the New York Times and Wirecutter's top pick 3 years in a row. This holiday season, Guardian is offering their biggest deal of the year. Up to 40% in savings on all bikes, plus $100 in free accessories. Guardian bikes have become the most sought-after gifts of the season, and inventory is going fast, so don't wait. Join over 500,000 happy families who've discovered the magic of Guardian. Shop now at guardianbikes.com. That's guardianbikes.com.